G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letteru.org. And we have, of course, in the background, our mascot, Prince Halevi the Fourth. He's there, isn't he, Yoel?
Yes, he's here, and he's eating his little sandwich and drinking his bottle.
Good on him. Good little Prince Halevi the Fourth. Yoel Ben Shlomo, thank you for coming back on the program. Hey, listen, we didn't do Samuel last week. Instead, we talked about the situation in Israel with the Gaza conflict and so on and so forth. Give us a quick update before we do get into 1 Samuel chapter 8.
Well, first of all, everyone's actually very angry at the government for doing the ceasefire. The problem is that people in the Western world don't understand Arab and Eastern mentality. Every time you're willing to negotiate, it's actually translated as a weakness. Mm-hmm. And this is not, it actually encourages them. And the Gazans are encouraged. And this is the problem.
They were declaring a victory.
Exactly. They declared a victory and they didn't really win anything. That's the joke. They actually... Mm-hmm. We really pummeled them deep into the ground, but the problem is that in their world, every time you stop, you cease, you try to be humanitarian, they can translate it as a weakness. And this is how the Arab and Muslim world works. So,
wait, let me understand this, because it baffles my mind, I have to say. It really does baffle my mind. How many people lost their lives in Gaza?
It was a couple dozen, but we hit really hard on Hamas infrastructure, and we got rid of several predominant characters in the Hamas
government. You wiped them out, and you absolutely trashed their buildings, and there were very, very precise strikes by the Israeli Defense Forces, and as you say, they were pummeled, and yet. When a ceasefire was declared, they're jumping up and down going, what a victory, we've got a victory. Is that because Israel is willing to engage in a ceasefire and they see that as a sign of weakness on behalf of Israel, therefore they are victorious? Is that really what goes on in their minds?
That's what goes on in their minds. They don't. You have to remember something. They're, in their mentality, they're still living... 2,500 years ago, they're still living in the mentality that you have to strike fear in the hearts of your enemy. They're still living in the mentality that unless you literally crush your enemy to the ground and kill everyone, you haven't defeated anything. And today in the world, people try to work through diplomacy. But there were several elements that were going on. First of all, Egypt threatened that if Israel goes in, they'll intervene. Now, first of all, Egypt was not allowed to do that. There's a Camp David agreement, and Egypt is not allowed to get involved in such situations. And if they do, they actually lose millions. You know, everyone talks about the millions or billions that the U.S. gives Israel, and no one really actually understands how that works. Israel gives about in between $50 to $60 billion worth of intel and technology to the United States. They don't really directly give us any money. The states that do receive directly money are actually Arab states, like, for example, Egypt. Egypt and the Palestinian Authority, for example, the Palestinian Authority receives over $200 million every year from taxpayers' money inside the United States. Israel, on the other hand, gives back to the United States the stuff that if we, for example, shut that faucet of that information and technology, the United States has no eyes in this area. Now, this is part of what people don't know. So all these leftists and liberals that go out and demonstrate, all these pro-Palestinians in the United States that demonstrate about the money they give to Israel, Israel is a productive body. We give back. We don't receive anything for free. On the other hand, the PA, Egypt, and other countries that the U.S. supports don't give anything back. So Israel's kind of being what's called date raped every time, every year, mm-hmm. because we don't really get anything for the United States. On the other hand, the U.S. is being fully raped by Arab countries that receive money from also the U.N., by the way. The U.N., UNESCO, for example, the U.S. shut down the funds from UNESCO, which was about $17 million, because mm-hmm. UNESCO was actually trying to say, oh, we recognize the Palestinian Authority as a state, which Palestinian Authority is not a state, but they're going to try to push one this week, and they're actually going to get it. They're going to be recognized as a state. And
you think that's going to come good? You think that's going to come good?
It's going to happen for one very simple reason. The UN has two bodies in it, the Western world and basically the communist Arab world. And, you know, China, for example, China in Tibet has done things that, you know, are horrendous. They've murdered Tibetans. They've literally taken over their country. Mm-hmm. Everything that the PA claims that Israel has done, China's actually done, and there's proof of it. The Dalai Lama, for example, is in exile for decades already because of the Chinese. And they run around and they say, we support the Chinese government says we support the PA. Pure hypocrisy. In other countries as well. And so there's actually pressure. They're saying, okay, we'll allow you to declare a state, which, by the way, is against the Oslo agreements. They're not allowed to do this. Just so you should know, they've been in breach of the Oslo agreement from basically day one, and that's what they do. This is what Arabs do. This is what Muhammad taught them to do. He told them, make an agreement, you're allowed to breach it immediately because they're heretics, they're heathens, and stuff like that. You know, you have an Arab standing in New York City with a sign saying, kill all Jews. You know, that's, you're supposed to arrest a person the moment they do that. It's enticement for murder. You know, whether he wrote "kill all juice," he didn't know how to spell juice, so he wrote "juice." So there's a whole bunch of jokes.
I did see that sign, and I wondered to myself, is he being clever because this way he won't get arrested, or can he just not spell?
He probably can't spell. It's like a whole bunch of, there was a demonstration a couple of years ago in the United States where Arabs were demonstrating, Muslims were demonstrating, because when you say Arabs, you're generalizing because there's Arabs, there's Christian Arabs and stuff like that. So I have to remember, when I say Arabs, and I think I've said this in the past before, when I say Arabs, I just mean Muslims, because Christians are different. For example, there's a village next to Jerusalem called Abu Ghosh that there's a large number of Christians, and they actually were supporters of Israel in 1948, and they're still supporters, and they benefit from it. Mm-hmm. They support Israel, and they actually benefit. They're a flourishing community. Their restaurants always have people in them. You know, there's a lot of groups that come here to Israel, and they go there because they know it's safe. So, you know, if you bless Israel, you get blessed as well. You curse Israel, you got dry wells down in Gaza. You have chaos in the PA. But essentially, what's going on? They're going to run off to the UN. The UN's going to approve it because the UN is no longer what it used to be, and they're going to declare we created the Palestinian state. And then they're going to start creating pressure. It's a state now. You have to leave Judea and Samaria. And now that basically the Israeli government saying, okay, you do that. That's breach of the Oslo agreement. By that point, the Oslo agreement is canceled. We don't owe you money. We don't give you services. We don't give you everything. And we can basically bring down the Palestinian Authority literally in a couple of weeks if we want to. Mm. So it's a very fragile thing, and they're actually highly dependent on us. If we say, okay, we forsake everything. And the other thing is, there's a discussion here regarding Hamas trying to take over the Judea and Samaria as well. You know, for example, every time we move out of somewhere, you know, we do it out of, you know, goodwill and everything. The extremists take over because now they can shoot anyone they want. And that's, by the way, what Hamas did to Fatah in the Gaza Strip. They actually started killing off Fatah people, and they fled. And there were a lot of what people call, but mistakenly call, Palestinians, who many of them, by the way, were Egyptian-born people who lived in the Gaza Strip, or were under the Egyptians. They ran off to Egypt. They went back to live in where they came from, which is Egypt. And they stayed there. They never came back. So, and they were talking about over 500,000 people running away from the Gaza Strip. So, and so how many are actually there? God knows. But anyhow, they're going to push this thing through, and it's going to be a pretty rough time, at least in the area where we live, you know, Judea and Samaria. It's going to be a rough time, and there's going to be, there has to be decision-making regarding what's going to be done. And essentially, they want to get rid of us. And that was a declaration back in the 1920s when they had the roundtable discussion of the Arab League, and they said we're declaring a 100-year war against the Zionists. So they're not looking for peace. They have an agenda, and it's pretty clear what the agenda is. But we're talking about a whole bunch of things. For example, they want East Jerusalem as their capital. Now, East Jerusalem is a new invention. For example, they're talking about villages. They've always done everything. I actually looked at images basically from the 1800s all the way into the 1930s, and you can see how the villages showed up, but in the beginning there was nothing there. People either live in the old city or nothing. And part of it's going to be that they're going to say we want East Jerusalem, which means they're going to demand the Muslim quarter and the Temple Mount as part of the Palestinian Authority state, and that starts putting a lot of shadows on the old city in general. On the Western Wall as well. They've been talking about the Western Wall belonging to them ever since. I mean, for example, there was the what's called the El Burak riots, where the Muslims, this was back in the 1920s, the Muslims declared that the Western Wall is called Al-Buraq, which was presumably the horse, the mare that that Muhammad had, and they claimed that when he went up to the Jerusalem, to the Al-Aqsa, which means the further mosque. By the way, his wife Fatima was actually a religious authority, was very clear about the fact that it was a dream. That it wasn't something that happened in reality. But they keep on declaring that it's the Temple Mount, and they basically said, yeah, the Western Wall is where Muhammad tied up his horse and went into the Temple Mount, and it belongs to us, it's significant to us. And they tried to take over, and the English were very compliant with the idea of them rioting. The English never did anything. They just stood at the side. And this is the mentality we're dealing with in the entire world. People, they're so scared of the Muslims. To crush the Muslims is actually a very, very easy thing to do. They're not that developed. The thing is, they use intimidation, and this scares people. And I've met people, like I said, they harshly talk about Muslims when they're not next to Muslims, and when they see Muslims, they chicken out. They don't have the ability to actually talk the bold words that they usually do. And the Muslims work on this, so it's going to be a really rough time here in Israel. This might be the beginning of the end of the PA. This might be the end of a lot of things. It might be beginning of a Palestinian state, which could be declaration of the end of the state of Israel. This is what people don't understand. Supporting the PA, supporting a Palestinian state, is supporting the destruction of the state of Israel, because this is what they want to do. End of story.
Mm-hmm. So coming back to the ceasefire, how is that looking? Have there been any rockets? Have there been any missiles?
So they actually breached the ceasefire in the beginning. They did fire two rockets, but they say it wasn't Hamas, it was Jihad, the Islamic Jihad. So it's not us. But the Islamic Jihad works with Hamas. It's a faction of another terrorist group from Hamas. By the way, Hamas is a terrorist group. And they actually breached the ceasefire literally seconds after it began. And then when Israel shot an Arab that was trying to break into break through the fence, they said, they ran out to the UN. Israel breached the... Yeah, and you fired two rockets the moment we declared the ceasefire. So, stop lying through your teeth. But people don't realize this. There's so much misinformation. I'm getting emails from people. It's like, is everything okay? We're looking at the news. I'm like, nothing's really going on. It's just, but the news is saying, no. And, it's not as problematic as people think it is, but it can be very problematic. For example, there were stoning cars not too far away from where I live. These are Arabs who, we supply them with water, we supply them with electricity. These are Arabs who actually live in what we call the sea areas, which are actually under control of Israel. There's basically divided up to A, B, and C. A is Palestinian Authority. B are areas that the Israeli forces can go in freely. They can't stop us or anything. And then C is Israeli controlled, but there are a lot of Arabs that live inside the Israeli controlled areas, because these are areas that are there are a lot of Jews living in these areas. And we're also talking about hundreds of thousands of Jews living in Judea and Samaria. Yes, the majority of population of Israel lives inside the Green Line, but there are hundreds of thousands of people living outside the Green Line in Judea and Samaria. And the question is, what are you going to do with us? What are you going to do with all these people living in Judea and Samaria?
Because that number is increasing, right?
The number is increasing daily. Mm. The numbers are actually increasing daily. I remember 10 years ago, they were talking about 230,000 people living. We've crossed that number. We're holding about 350,000, and that's in 10 years. And it's probably even more than that. It's probably getting close to almost 500,000 people living in Judea and Samaria. What are you going to do with these people? So the Arabs basically, the Arabs said years ago, we're going to drive the Zionists into the ocean. And we have to start really standing for ourselves and just, look at the world and give them the raspberry and continue on with what we're doing, because, we can't allow this. You don't understand. It's the United States, for example. You have entire areas, for example, in Detroit that are Muslim controlled, and they're calling for Sharia law. People don't get this. This is what Arabs do. They take over. This is what they do. They will never, ever, ever assimilate into your culture. you know, this very democratic liberal mindset that people come with is like, oh, you know, they have the right to abode wherever they want and stuff like that. So you're just declaring that your state is going to crumble in about 50 years down the road. Germany is going to be Germanistan, and Britain is going to be Britistan, or Londistan, and the U.S. is going to be United States of Arabia. You know, I've said this before, and I think that, you know, people are not waking up. People are actually not waking up because they have inside really suffering from the hands of Islam. And when it happens, then people, you know, don't turn around to Israel and say, oh, okay, you were right, you know. But it's too late, so let's just submit.
The 75,000 reservists that were called up, that were gathering around the borders, have they pulled back? Are they dismantling? What's happening?
Yeah, they've pulled back. They've pulled back.
Okay. So they expect this to last. They expect this to last a little while before we have to start thinking again about possibly going in.
Yeah, I mean, there's talks now. They're meeting up in Egypt. Hamas faction and Israel diplomats are meeting up in Egypt with Hamas and finalizing the agreement. But they never hold to them. You know, it'll be quiet for say 6 months, maybe a year, and they'll start firing again. Oh, Israel did something. Therefore, we know. And I personally think they're going to start firing again the moment that Abbas goes to the UN and gets his state.
Meanwhile, they're digging up Arafat. I think they've dug him up now, and they're doing tests on him to see whether or not Israel knocked him off through a toxicology report. Also, Morsi in Egypt is trying to become the world's most powerful dictator, and everyone's up in arms about that. Do either of those things have potential to turn bad for Israel?
So if they actually find polonium on Arafat's bones, it doesn't necessarily mean that we did it, but obviously they'll try to manipulate it to say that we did. Mm-hmm. Because there aren't too many states that actually have this substance. It's a very powerful radioactive substance, and they claim Israel has access to it. We probably do. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember something. Arafat was a terrorist.
He was a terrorist.
Terrorist to begin with. He lived as a terrorist, died as one. Yeah. And he didn't hide the fact that he's a terrorist. And by the way, he wore uniform every day. Mm-hmm. And it was part of his persona. He basically ran around declaring that he's a soldier in the armies of Allah. And he basically didn't hide what he was doing. He was basically forcing the world to recognize a terrorist as a partner to peace. Mm. Yeah, peace here and peace there. But he was a terrorist, and it's well known that he was a terrorist. So I have no remorse. If Israel killed him, thank God they did.
Amen. I totally agree. And we may find out that perhaps they did, or we may find out that he died of natural causes, but they will be doing that toxicology report.
Well, by the way, he was very, very sick to begin with. You know, he was a child bugger. There's rumors that he was a homosexual, that he probably had AIDS. Sua Arafat knew very well what he was doing, and that's why she grabbed the money and ran, because she knew what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. She knew her husband was a criminal. Her husband stole. They're talking about millions and millions of dollars that Arafat received from the world as aid for the Palestinians, and he stole most of it. And this is, by the way, when I was studying a civil law here in Israel in high school, they were talking about the problems in the Arab culture where the head of the tribes just take everything for themselves. If you walk around an Arab village, you know, there's sewage in the street. Why is there? Oh, it's because of Israel. No, it's because the truth is because the Arab governments of sorts don't really care about their own people. They get into power, and then they have power of manipulation. And you know, if you ever look into it, for example, when the Fatah was overthrown by the Hamas, they discovered, for example, videos of women that were basically told, "If you want help with this, you have to sleep with us." And there were videos. Right. There were actually Fatah members filming each other to actually have stuff they can bribe. You know, they can actually blackmail people. In the Fatah archives and everything. And this is what Fatah was doing in Gaza. And the Hamas is probably even worse because the Hamas starts killing people. Yeah, this is part of the issue. So people don't really understand what we're dealing with. Now, I'm not generalizing. No, not all Arabs are bad. Not all Muslims are that terrible. I know quite a few Muslims which are really, really nice people, and they're actually... Sure. But I'm saying, in a general concept, when we're dealing with the PA and Hamas, we're dealing with terrorists who terrorize Jews, who terrorize civilians, who don't care about killing people. And by the way, a lot of the people, you know, they're talking about civilians and everything. You know, listen, there were soldiers murdered by civilians. There were Jews murdered by civilians. These are not, you know, these are not people that, you know, belong to Hamas or belong to Islamic Jihad or any of Al-Quds, the malicious groups of Al-Quds and everything. Sometimes these are just civilians who decide we're going to act on behalf of the Palestinians. We're going to be some guy who works works for Jews, for example. He can be working in the market, or he could be working in construction in a neighborhood, a Jewish neighborhood, and he's all friends, the family, and everything. And then in the evening, he goes out to demonstrate. He throws rocks. He gets a gun and starts shooting. You know, stuff like that. This is what we're dealing with. These are people who are really, I mean, what, two-faced? We're talking about real two-faced people. And everything you have to really, anything the PA says, anything Hamas says, you always have to be very suspicious of what they say. Very, very suspicious. And people just get into their heads. This is the mentality that Israel has to deal with, and the world is stupid enough to fall for it.
Well, in the meantime, there is a ceasefire, and I hope it holds, because I'm coming over there in March, Joel. I'm coming over there with a bunch of people with Keith Johnson, and I certainly hope that we will be able to travel around freely and experience the land. And for me, that'll be the first time. So, but certainly, I hope it holds for all the citizens of Israel, that they can get on peacefully with their life without the threat of running to having to run to a bomb shelter.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Anyhow. One of the last times Keith was here, we went to the Aviv search in March. We actually went down south, and Keith was like looking in places, and he saw all these signs saying, you know, bomb shelter 10 meters that way or something. And Keith was like, what is this? And we actually filmed it, where I explained that this is a sign here that says the bomb shelter 10 minutes away or 10 meters away and stuff like that. And he's like, really? This is the reality people live in? And the answer is yes, this is the reality. The people who live down south in the 40, 50 kilometer radius from the Gaza Strip, this is the reality they've been living in since Israel made the decision to leave the Gaza Strip. Now, it was a decision, by the way, first of all, it was a decision made by a father called Alex Sharon, who was a criminal, and his sons were criminals, and they've actually been convicted. And this was a spin. They got out of going to court by expelling thousands of Jews from their houses in the Gaza Strip. And now they're calling, for example, the head of the mayor of Kiryat Malachi was actually attacked last week because he was a big supporter of the expulsion of Jews from the Gaza Strip. And they're now, everyone that supported, they're blaming them. They're saying, it's your fault that they were in this situation. And we, the right-wingers, are standing here, the people who actually understand what's going on, we're standing and say, hello, we said this when they came up with this idea. There was peace and quiet. I mean, there were the occasional rockets and everything, but there was essentially peace and quiet down south. And ever since the expulsion of the Jews of Gaza Strip, there have been rockets, and they always see these things as signs of weakness. Always.
So that's where we're up to. That's the update. Thank you for that, my friend. And but in any case, I hope the ceasefire does continue. I hope it is a significant time of peace. But as Keith says, time will tell. And we'll wait and see, and we'll keep up with the news. But right now, my friend, we're in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Shall we jump in there?
I think we should. I mean, we've been talking for quite a while about other things.
We've been schmoozing. We better kick into it. This is where we are, and it begins like this. It says, now you just interrupt me when you want, because really this is, I mean, this is kind of a short chapter, and it all flows into itself. But I know there's some things that you want to pull in there, but it begins like this. It came to pass, Joel, when Samuel, well, he was old, and he made his sons judges over Israel, and the name of his firstborn was Yoel. There you go.
Uh-huh.
And the name of his second, Abiyah, and they were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways, Yoel. They turned aside after dishonest gain, and they took bribes, and they perverted justice. And all the elders of Israel gathered together, and they came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said, look, you're old. He says, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge like all the nations, so they can judge us like the nations. There we go.
Okay, first of all, there's a few things we have to pay attention to. There's actually a bit of criticism here about a few things. But it's quite surprising that actually it's quite surprising what's going on with the sons. I mean, we're talking again, we have a righteous man like Eli, and he has two sons like Eli, different names, obviously. Actually, names which are a lot more Israelite. You know, Hophni and Pinchas, we mentioned that it's probably something a bit more Egyptian that probably flowed in the family of Aaron. And here we have more pure Jewish names. Yoel, my name. But I'm not like the Yoel here, by the way. I'm trying to be a bit more righteous than that.
Right.
Aviyah, which means my father, is Yah. Yoel, by the way, I never explained this, but Yoel, some people say, is an abbreviation of Yehoel, which means the Lord is God. So this is a very, very Israelite name. And Aviyah means Yah is my father. And they are judges. They actually said that he actually puts them as judges, Shoftim. So we're going back to what we had as the judges in the older times. But they're sitting in Be'er Sheva, in Beersheba, which is, by the way, Be'er Saba, which is basically not too far away from Be'er Sheva of today, which, by the way, holds one of the bigger Karaite communities in Israel. And actually been there quite a few times. I when I was in the military, our base, we had to travel through Beersheba to actually get to our base. And it's a very flat place, by the way. It's just very flat. But they're in Be'er Sheva, which means they chose the most remote city of Israel to sit there. Their father went through all the land all the time, and they went to Ramah, which is in the center of the land. They ran off to the south. There's a bit of criticism about that. But there's also a hint here that the, and this is part of, I think, the dilemma of the writer, because he's basically talking about, well, when sons inherit their father's position, they don't really do a good job. So there's actually criticism here about the whole kingship thing, because every time someone inherited from their father, we had you know, Moses and Joshua, it wasn't father to son, but it was leader to leader. That worked very well. Problem is, Joshua never actually gave anyone else the position, so it was chaos. Then we had Gideon or Yerubbaal and his son, Avimelech takes the position, and he did a really, really bad job. And then Eli has his sons, and they do a really, really bad job. And now we have Samuel, and he has his sons, and they're doing a really, really bad job. There's a hint here, which leads into the story. You have to remember something. The Bible doesn't work. The flow from one story to the other doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the flows that we're used to in storylines that are used in books that we have today. There's a logical flow. Here, the flow is context. We take from one point to the other. There's a flow from an idea to an idea. It's not necessarily historical. This is why, for example, you have a storyline here. Like, for example, we have in the book of Numbers, we have in Exodus, it says, Jethro went to meet up with Moses, and he talks with him, and he gives him the advice about the 70 elders, etc., and then he goes back to his place. Then we have Mount Sinai. Now, why is that story there in the middle? The story there is there in the middle to make sure that people that we know that the Exodus and what happened was well known in the world. That story actually truly happened probably after the Mount Sinai incident.
Okay.
Because we go into Numbers, and suddenly in Numbers, Jethro wants to leave, and then we have an expansion of the story just before he left and what happened and what was suggested and stuff like that. So it doesn't really work in storyline flow. It works in connotation, what's connected to what. So this is why this story isn't here, because it's connected. We had the story of Samuel, how he becomes a true judge and everything. Then we have a connection with what goes after with, but it's really connected to the next stage in the story, which is Saul. So we have this story smack in the middle, in between the development of Samuel and the rise of Saul. And we're bringing in there's like little hints here that you'll be surprised. I've been studying the past couple of years the Bible in a lot more context, historical context, and I'm recognizing places where there's, for example, political polemics inside the text. We're talking about this, talking about that. There are places where it's very evident. Like, for example, Isaiah says, "And the Lord removed me from following these people," and they're talking about the two factions that existed in Jerusalem. One's at times of King Hezekiah, one's that supported surrendering to the Assyrians, and the other faction that was supporting King Hezekiah and basically the Torah, saying we're going to listen to the prophets, we're going to listen to the commands of God. And there's places where you can see that, but there are places where it's very, very subtle. You know, one day when we get to Isaiah, I'll probably point out some of them, but you'll be surprised. Jeremiah, the politics is very, very clear. Ezekiel, he's coming more from the priestly position, so he's talking more about, you know, the adulterous woman and not following Torah. Isaiah is kind of funny because there's these little political hints here and there, but you really have to pay attention to them to actually notice them. So the same thing goes on here. There's subtleties. So now we're having criticism about the sons of Samuel. It's probably criticism about the whole idea of inheriting the leadership, inheriting the kingship. And because there is a dilemma. You see this dilemma throughout the historical writings, goes through the Book of Kings as well, regarding what do we do with this kingship? And the dilemma starts here as well. And then we can carry on into what the elders do. So they
come and they say, so listen, you're old and your sons don't do the things properly, and now so give us a king. We want a king to judge over us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to Jehovah, and Jehovah said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me that I should reign over them.
This is a very, very important key element. It's the issue of having a king, because the Torah, and we're going to touch on that, the Torah says, yeah, you can have a king like the rest of the nations, but the king has a lot of limitations on him because he's not the supreme power. You have to understand that in the ancient world, the king was divine. He was divinely appointed. In some traditions, for example, in Egypt and Assyria, the king was a divine being. He was a descendant of the gods. When the gods descended from the heavens and they appointed their king and everything, here the Torah kind of basically goes in the line of like, he's a human being. He's really like everyone else, and there's nothing special here. But they're saying, we're not interested. Part of what's going on here is they're saying, we're not interested in the kingship of God, because as far as we see it, he's doing a terrible job. So we want a tangible man that we can trust and we can criticize if necessary. So it's not just saying that they're fed up of God being their king. It's a lot more than that. They're saying, they're basically declaring that they don't trust in God anymore.
So hang on, and if I understand you correctly, Yoel, let me see if I can get this straight in my head. They're saying, listen, Samuel, you're the guy chosen by God, and you've been the prophet for us for a while now. And look, you've been pretty good, right? You're all right. I mean, everything that you say that happens, and so we're good with you. But look, your sons are no good, and if they're going to inherit the gig, you know, we're not going to be really impressed with that, because they're not like you. But listen, how about we ditch the whole prophet thing altogether? Why don't we have Give us a king like the nations have a king. Look over there at Egypt. Egypt have got these kings, and their kings are divine. Their kings have godlike status. I mean, you've done the God thing now for a little while, and it's been all right. But listen, give us a king, because your sons aren't going to cut us. Give us a divine godlike king. Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're telling me?
That's basically it. They're saying, well, for example, you know, turn around and say, well, let's be realistic for a moment. Do you really think this is going to work? You know, and stuff like that I've heard before from different people. You know, I'll be realistic. You know, there's no, for example, there's a lot of discussions here in Israel regarding people who decide to leave the country and say, oh, be realistic. You can't really make any money here in Israel. You can't really live here in Israel. You know, be realistic. Go move to the United States. Now, seriously, we know where the United States is standing on the finances these days. It's not what it was 20 years ago when the United States was a very, very strong country. The economy in the United States is doing really, really bad. And, but you still have the people who say, oh, let's be realistic. You can't make money here in Israel. Same thing here. They're saying, let's be realistic. We really need an organized army. You know, I mean, let's be realistic. We really do need a tangible leadership that no one can actually undermine. You know, we want to see power. We want to see strength. We want to see a guy who stands there with his shield and his javelin and his weapons, and he commands an army. We want to see that. And, you know, we want to see the glorious action figure from I don't know, whatever action movie you want. We want to see that. And it kind of reminds me of what Isaiah says, where he says that they have forsaken the waters of the Shiloh that flow slowly, and they're glorifying Ratzinan and the son of Remaliahu. It's what's been hinted there is like, you know, these strong guys who pose, and they have all these muscles, and they, you know, there's pictures of them on people's walls and everything. This is what you want. And basically their turnaround says, we want a king, but we want a human hero. We want our Superman here. Which, by the way, if you, I don't know if you ever noticed this, but Superman is actually a Jewish character. I don't know if anyone's ever noticed that. His real name is Kal-El, which means the light one of El. And Superman was actually created by two Jews in the 1930s. Just an FYI.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm actually very, very serious. I was sitting in the bus one day, and I was going like, well, Superman, it's really funny. I was having a discussion with myself. Well, Superman's really called Kal-El, which means the light one of God. I actually went on Wikipedia and looked it through, and it was two Jews who created the Superman character, which is really funny. But anyhow, they want a Superman. They want this superhero that's going to stand there on the chariot and command the military. And they're basically saying, well, we're fed up with what we were doing up to now because this is the style we did in the desert. We want to be a modern country. We want to be a modern state. We want to dress modern. We want a king. We want this. We want that. And we want to forsake everything we've done up to now. And the hint of this is really we're fed up of God, and this is the criticism. And when you focus on something, there's always like the one thing that's really the point that causes everything. And basically, he's saying the elders are fed up of God. The elders are fed up. The nation is fed up of the old ways. We want to be modern. And God basically says, okay, listen. You know what? I did command in the Torah that they can have a king. I gave them rules and regulations of how to follow, how to have a king. And you just tell them, you know, I have no problem with you having a king, but he has to submit to my rules. Because I told you, you can have a king, but my rules.
So, they wanted kind of a different kind of king, right? They're kind of saying, hey, look, we've done the God thing. You know, Samuel, you're the prophet, but you're old now. Your sons clearly aren't going to cut it. So, you know, we want a king like the nations. And Yehovah goes on to say, he said, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also, Samuel. Now, therefore, heed their voice. Sure. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. Okay,
This is actually a very, very key, important thing. So it says in Hebrew, so Ed Ta'id is you will testify, which is actually a language of, to a certain degree, a language of covenant, where he basically says, well, for example, it says, he says, I take the heavens and the earth as witnesses that you will perish if you do X, Y, Z. So the same thing here, he's basically saying, I will go and be a witness. So he's basically saying, you know, okay, we're making this decision. You want a king, but here's the warning and here's the testimony, which is almost like a covenant here. And you will tell them, and you will tell them, Mishpat HaMelech. So the word Mishpat usually means judgment and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But Mishpat HaMelech here in this case actually means, and this was part of I personally think it's a misunderstanding, but a dispute in the academic world regarding the verses from verse 11 all the way to the end of the verses 11 all the way to verse 17 regarding what does it mean the law of the king. So they translate it as law of the king, but it really means the custom or the ways of the king.
And, so I've got behavior of the king, which behavior, is probably not too far from the truth. Yeah.
Yeah, mishpat hamelech. If it was say behavior, it would have said minhag hamelech, the nohag or something, which means the behavior. Mishpat hamelech here usually means that mishpat usually means judgment and stuff like that. But here in context, it really means the custom of the king. This is, you know, tell them what kings do. So it's actually not a contradiction to what we have in the book of Deuteronomy about the ruling of the king and what the king does, because in Deuteronomy it's doing one thing, here Samuel's doing something else.
Before we go on, shall I just read Deuteronomy chapter 17 from verse 14, just to bring everybody up to speed? Should we just do that?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so it says, when you come into the land... Okay, so here we are. You come into the land which Jehovah your God is giving you, and you possess it and you dwell in it, and say, I will set up a king over me like all the nations that are around me. You shall surely set a king over you, whom Jehovah your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you, and you may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For Yehovah has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Also, it shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this Torah in a book from the one before the priests and the Levites, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear Yehovah his God, and be careful to observe all the words of this Torah and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left hand, that he may prolong his days in the kingdom and his children in the midst of Israel.
So basically what the Torah is saying is here is this is a down-to-earth king, a humble one that is not going to be that powerful. He's not going to be an emperor. And this is part of the issue. They want an emperor. They want this glorious king with riches and everything. And Torah says, no, he's like a shepherd king. He's a simple king. He's not going to run around with jewelry and women and everything. And
he's not going to lord it over the people, right? He's going to be one of them. He's one of the guys.
Exactly. He's one of the guys, and he can be criticized. And, for example, Saul and David are criticized, and other kings are criticized as well by the prophets. And they're actually underneath the Torah. And to a certain degree, the king is probably not even above the high priest. Probably the king and the high priest are more or less on the same level. He's the civil law. He's the civil authority, and he's the religious authority. So basically, in the Torah, there are two authorities. There are two powers, and really the Torah power, the high priesthood, keeps the king in check. Mm-hmm. That's part of what goes on. And these things were reversed. So, for example, in the Second Temple period, the high priesthood was actually in check by the kingship, or at one point by the Romans. So that's a complete reversal of what was actually done. But let's look at very quickly a few pointers here. So it says you have to take a king from your brothers. And you can't be a foreigner. And that was part of the discussion with Agrippa the First. That, you know, he was actually the last king of it, last king of the Jews. Officially a king, and he basically was an Edomite.
He was an Edomite, right? But he was an Edomite, but he was a Jewish convert. Was he a Jewish convert? I mean, how do we define that as Agrippa is concerned?
So the issue is as follows. His father was not Jewish. His mother probably was. He was a descendant of the Hasmonean house. Mm-hmm. So they declared themselves as kings at one point. Mm-hmm. So there's a dilemma here because his father was not Jewish, but his mother was. But the problem with his mother, the problem is that genealogy doesn't go through the father, through the mother, it goes through the father, which mm-hmm. means his mother was married to a non-Jew. And there's this concept of conversion through marriage, which basically kind of nullifies who the woman originally was. Mm-hmm. But we, in modern-day Judaism, in Pharisaic Judaism, Talmudic Judaism, we usually say the heritage goes through the mother, the Jewish heritage, meaning being Jewish or not Jewish, goes through the mother. But at that time, a lot of people still followed through the father, not the mother. And by the way, that was the original. It didn't go through the mother, it went through the father, because the father was the dominant character in the family.
It's not the children of Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel, right? It's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yeah, it's basically the difference in between a patriarch and a matriarch society. Mm. So the Israelite society is a patriarch society, which means belong to a certain group based on your father's lineage and not your mother's. Mm-hmm. Which raises a lot of issues with a lot of things. But at one point, the part of the discussion was that they say that around the Roman occupation, they moved it to the mother because some people say even from the Greek times even happened, there were women who were raped and they had children, and they were saying, what do we do with these kids? On one hand, we can't throw them to the dogs. On the other hand, you know, they're not really Jewish. So they came out with this rule, oh, it goes with the mother. And they were planning on reversing that at one point. It was never reversed. But there's a lot of debate regarding this thing. I've met people that say, oh, it doesn't matter. It can be either the mother or the father. In modern-day Judaism, they say through the mother. I personally think it's actually through the father. That the person's heritage goes to the father, everything goes to the father, because that's actually what you see mostly in the Bible.
When you say mostly, is there an example where we don't see that? I mean, as far as I am aware, that is the example that we have.
In the time of Ezra, there was this whole development of the holy seed and stuff like that, and it looks as if they were highly concerned with the marriage of foreign women. The question is if they were concerned because they were following idols, or because the children were not receiving a Jewish heritage, or that they were kind of against the idea of marrying foreign women because the children actually are not Jewish. So there's a lot of discussions. But historically wise, I actually looked into it. They say historically wise, it originally went through the father, and it was changed at some point. But when you look in the Bible, you see, for example, there was a man called Hiram who worked for King Solomon, and his mother was Jewish, but his father was a Canaanite or a Sedanite or something from Sidon or something, and he was still taken for work in the temple. So you know, there's information to here, information to there, and it's not very, very clear. But going over this very, very quickly, so you can't be a foreigner. Now, the issue of bringing horses. So the Torah basically says not to bring horses and not to return to Egypt. So there's a whole bunch of opinions here. One of them is that it's not making agreements with the Egyptians, because the Torah forbids making agreements with nations.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, do not cut a covenant with them and their gods. So the Torah, I've seen an interpretation, it's not just an issue of returning to Egypt. It's not just an issue of, you know, having a lot of horses and accumulating riches and stuff like that. It also has to do with cutting covenants, which also has to connected to the issue of marrying many wives. King Solomon, for example, all those wives, those were political marriages. Those are ways of sealing agreements with other nations. You just take the daughter.
Surely not all of them. You know? Surely not all of them. I mean, he had hundreds of wives and hundreds of concubines. But about, yes, a lot of them would have been politically motivated, no doubt. But he did. Now, I mean, you brought him up. We even know where the stables of Solomon are, right? I mean, the guy had horses. The guy had a lot of wives, and it seems to fly in the face of what we're reading here.
So yeah, they say in Megiddo there's supposed to be a lot of horse stables and stuff like that. By the way, what they call King Solomon's stables in the Temple Mount. That has nothing to do with King Solomon. That's
But was there not a recent archaeological discovery believed to be the stables of Solomon?
Could be. I'm not really big on archaeology. I mean, I don't follow everything in archaeology, so it could be. I vaguely remember something like that, but I can't say that I do. If we find it, maybe we should post it somewhere so people can have.
There's one for the comments. If any of the listeners know any more about that, let us know. But you know, whether he had a great deal of horses or not, he certainly had an incredible amount of wives and concubines, which does kind of seem to fly in the face of what we read here.
Yeah, and then the last thing he has to do is he has to write his own copy of the Torah, and it goes with him wherever he goes. So in Rabbinic Judaism, they say he wrote a very, very small version, a very, very small copy of the Torah, and he had it strapped to his arm. That's probably not realistic, but probably what it means is that he had a Torah bearer. He had someone who carried a Torah with him, or everywhere he went, he had a copy of the Torah with him. Mm. Even if you write very, very small, first of all, it will become unreadable. If it's extremely small writing, it will become unreadable. Hmm. I actually looked at sizes of Torah scrolls, you know, these children Torah scrolls and everything. It's doable, but it's probably not what was done.
No, because I mean, it says make a copy of this law in a book is what I've got in the New King James. But obviously, it's a scroll, right? I mean, we're talking about a scroll.
Yeah, it's a scroll. Now, what we say a book today, a codex form that was invented way later. I mean, Maimonides, for example, talks about the idea that he found a copy of the Talmud still written as a scroll. So the whole idea of books, I think, showed up around the 8th or 9th century. Mm-hmm. That's why the Aleppo Codex, for example, is an actual book. Now, a book is always easier because flipping through is a lot faster. I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever dealt with a scroll. It takes a while. You know, we have and there's a way of rolling a Torah scroll really, really fast to get to the point that you want to read in. So, mm-hmm. You know, the book form is always better. But when the Torah says a book, sefer, it actually means a scroll. Now, when it says Megillat Sefer, when it uses the term of Megillat Sefer, a mm-hmm. scroll of book, it's probably a scroll written on parchment. So it's like the highest quality, because you can write a book on papyri and stuff like that, But when you want to really have something that's high quality and everything, you had a scribe sit down with scans and write it down and everything. So it's quite possible that there were copies of the Torah written on papyrus instead of actual skins. But still, you have to remember, the process of writing a Torah scroll, it takes a very, very long time. Even if you write simple handwriting, you know, the it still takes a very, very long time
to write. It's still a labor-intensive operation, sure, absolutely. Yep. Okay, so that's all right, so that's Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 to the end, verse 20, and that's the details in regards to the Torah regarding the king. And but here we go in 1 Samuel 8 from verse 10, Yehovah says, look, you better tell them, Samuel, they want a king like that. This is what's going to happen. So Samuel told all the words of Yehovah to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, listen, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. Here we go. Ready? He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his own horsemen. And some of them will run before his chariots, and he will appoint captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and let some plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of the grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take your male servants and your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys, and put them to his work. And he will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants, and you will cry out in the day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and Yehovah will not hear you in that day.
So what exactly is he doing here? What actually has been described here is what kings in the ancient Near East used to do. Everything you see here is exactly the same what they used to do. They would take people. And we see it with Saul. Saul, every time he saw someone he thinks would fit, says, oh, come and join me. Now, there's a verb here which is yikach. In the Hebrew, it's yikach, which is a future form. The root is lakach, lamed kuf and chet. And it means to take. Now, does it mean forcefully take? The answer is, well, first of all, a man can't walk up to another man and cause him to be a slave. Okay, so basically what it means here, he's going to turn around and use his authority as a king and say, okay, I want that person. That's number one. So he goes around, he needs, you know, all the basic things a king needs, which he has a chariot, you know, king doesn't walk. So Joseph had a chariot of his own that was one of the signs of being a ruler. And he actually had a secondary chariot together with Pharaoh. So kings never really rode the backs of horses. That was really, you know, generals and servants and stuff like that. And what's very interesting is it doesn't seem like King David had a chariot. He didn't even have a horse. He used to ride the back of a donkey.
He had a mule, didn't he?
He had a mule, which is kind of interesting. So King David is like the grand king, the one who really understands his position. It's very interesting. He was the second king of Israel, but he did not go around, you know, saying, I'm a glorious king. Oh, you know, I'm Henry VIII. I am Henry. He didn't do that. You know, he was like, I'm David. He never, you know, he woke up and says, oh, hello, I'm David. He's like, people go like, you know who that is? That's King David. Imagine a guy who walks up to you. He's the king over the entire people of Israel. And he says to you, oh, I'm David. Hello. And you know, like, you're just David? That's basically who he was. This is why he is the beloved of God. He was extremely humble. And this is what the Torah wants the king to be. Mm-hmm. But Samuel's basically turning around and says, well, if you get a kind of a nasty king or a king that's really like the nations, this is what he's going to do. So he said, you want a king like the nations? This is what a king of the nation does. So he wants his chariots. He wants his soldiers. He wants his guys that ride on the backs of horses. He wants people to run in front of his chariot, because, you know, a king would sometimes go out and ride about the city or go into the land and then go around, and he has his small army around him and everything. Mm-hmm. And they actually had runners that would run in front of the chariot and declare the king is coming.
And announce him. And we read about, well, we read about that in a number of places. The first one that springs to mind is in Esther.
Well, that's kind of it. That's kind of what...
there's an example there of... I think Haman has to do it, doesn't he?
Yeah, but that's
his idea, wasn't it? It was Haman's idea.
Well, it's not exactly like that. I actually disagree with something like that, because he wasn't running for the horse. He was carrying the horse, and he would actually declare that, you know, this is what will be done to a man the king favors. Actually, I would think more of, for example, King Solomon had the runners before his chariot with the gold shields.
Mm.
And this, you know, you can't really make a shield out of gold and do anything. So here it was more a time of peace, so you don't really need soldiers running in front of the king's chariot. What you need is, like, people, you know, imagine like a golden army marching before the king. They had 300 of these shields, yeah, and spears, and there's this golden army marching before the king. It was more an issue of, you know, showing off, kind of, and showing some glory. And it's kind of interesting. King Solomon was actually the opposite of his father. He was like money and gold and women and everything. And King David was the exact opposite. He had wives, but not like 9 bazillion. And he didn't run around with, you know, gold and stuff like that. But he, you know, he had, for example, a crown with a big crown with a large jewel in it. That's described that he took it from, I can't remember if it was the king of one of the northern nations, I think it was. And they say it was a pretty massive crown. It was very expensive. But he wasn't as noisy as other kings. He was very, very humble. But everything we see description here, you know, to put for himself, you know, sergeants of thousands or ministers of thousands and fifties, and, you know, to plow his ground and everything. Basically saying, you know, when you have a king, it's servitude. You're going to have to supply the king with everything he needs. The one thing that's very peculiar here that I think is peculiar is verse 14, where it says that he will take fields and give it to his servants. So First of all, giving fields to the servants, that's actually something normal. It's a grant the king has the right to give to his servants. A typical thing, very common. Saul actually talks about it when he's sitting under the tree. He goes like, "Oh, you support David, and, you know, he's going to give you land and everything." It was something quite normal. The question is, what do you mean he takes your fields? I mean, this is your inheritance. This is your rights on the land.
Yeah.
So I've been pondering about this, and first of all, it could be that he's describing and saying, "No, that's against Torah. If you're going to have a king, there's a good chance he's going to break Torah by trying to take your land, like we had with Ahab, with Ahab, who tried to take the land of Navot.
Yes.
He tried to take the field of Navot. Actually, it was a vineyard, and that was an illegal action. And he actually says, "Now, I will judge you over the blood of Navot." You know, so it's actually a serious accusation. And I'm thinking, what is he doing? Is he just stating facts? You know, this is what kings might do? Or does this mean that the king actually can turn around to a person and say, "Look, listen, you have your land, and, you know, it's a really nice piece of land, and I want to buy it off of you. You can sell the land as long as you give it back." That might be it.
Could be.
That the king will turn around and say, "No, I want this piece of land. Please sell it to me." You know, he has to be nice about it. So I have a bit of a dilemma, because he uses the same root over and over and over again. And it's actually interesting that the root of lakach, in many cases, doesn't necessarily mean to take forcefully. It can also mean buying. And it says in Deuteronomy, and if a man takes a woman, ki yikach ish isha, you know, when we did the whole discussion about divorce, we mentioned this. So yikach there actually means he pays money. There's a contract here. No,
but Yoel, Ahab, remind me, didn't he initially want to buy the vineyard? And it wasn't for sale. He wouldn't sell it to him.
And that's why
Jezebel raised up some false accusations against him and had him killed and then took the land. But so, I mean, why would this be... Why would Yehovah be saying to the people, "Listen, this is going to be the behavior of the king. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. He's going to do this. He's going to buy your land from you if you're good enough to sell it to him. He'll buy your land." I don't know that works.
So I'm actually trying to find this. Give me a second. I think he said, "I'll buy it," because he's not allowed. You know, and it's interesting. Even in the northern kingdom, the king was aware of the fact that this is this man's inheritance. You don't take this. If you want it, you have to pay for it.
Yeah.
It's chapter 21, First Kings chapter 21, and he says to him, "Give me your vineyard, and it will be a vegetable field for me," basically vegetation or greens and stuff. The question is if he means here to grow like zucchini and stuff like that, or does he mean to actually, you know, have it as a some kind of a flower garden or something?
Well, this is the thing, because that's the thing that pops into my head. that he says he's going to take the best of your fields. I like that field. I want you to work that field for me. It's your field, but you work it for me, and I want the produce of that field. Maybe that's what it means.
No, I disagree with you because of what happens then. He says he'll take a tenth of everything from their fields. So I think actually it connects to chapter 21 of Book of Kings, First Kings, where he says to him, you know, I'll give you a different field, a better field, a better vineyard, and if not, I'll give you money. So he's basically, even in the northern kingdom, they weren't really following Torah. This thing he was very aware of. You know, a king can't march into someone's field and say, I want that. That's mine. No, he can't do that. Mm-hmm. This is protected by divine law. And this is how it was in the ancient world. This piece of land is protected by divine law that it belongs to my family. You can't take it away. If you do that, you're in breach of Torah, or you're in breach in the eyes of the gods. Mm-hmm. King can't do anything he wants. Even in the ancient world, you know, king was divine, but he didn't have the power to do whatever he wanted. For example, in Egypt, the only reason Pharaoh and the temples controlled the lands was only because they sold it to the king in the times of Joseph.
True.
Same thing here. So I don't think he takes away forcefully. He probably buys it off of them. And then we have the whole thing of he takes a tenth. He uses the term of tithing, but it's not really a tithe. It's he takes a tenth of the fields for himself because he has to supply. So it's actually a tax. It's taxation. Hmm. Telling you know, living kind of freely here. You've been, you know, any produce you have belongs to you. Now when you take a king, it's not going to be just yours. He's going to walk in with his tax authority and basically say, I want a tenth of that.
Hmm. That's what, and it's not just that. So it's a tenth of the grain and it's the vintage and so on and so forth. But it also says in verse 17, he'll also take a tenth of your sheep, so your livestock as well, and you will be his servants. And verse 18, you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourself, and Yehovah will not hear you in that day.
And that's what happened. With Solomon's son, they turned around to him and said, well, listen, your father was kind of hard on us. We had to work for him really hard. Blah, blah, blah. Do us a favor, you're cut some slack and leave us alone. And God was the one who turned his heart. He turned, what's his name? Rehavam's.
In English, it's Rehoboam.
Rehoboam. I can't stand the English names that they give. Sometimes I have nothing to do with the way the name is actually mentioned in Hebrew.
So just remind, because I know it messed with your head when Keith tried to explain to you about Jeroboam. How do you pronounce Rehoboam in the Hebrew?
So Rehoboam is Rehavam, which means expansion of the nation. And with Jeroboam, I kept on saying Jeroboam because it's Yerovam.
Yerovam.
I'm not used to the English names. I always use the Hebrew name. And when I was trying to explain to someone about King Josiah, and I kept on forgetting how to say Josiah. So I said, Yoshiao. I'm hoping the guy knows what I mean.
Yoshiao.
His real name was Yoshiao. Anyhow, so yeah, and that's what happened with Rehavam. I'm going to insist using the Hebrew name. Rehavam, that he turned he was told, you know, leave us alone, let us breathe. And he said, no, my pinky is bigger than them. Jokingly saying, my smallest finger. Basically, in other words, my pinky is thicker than my father's waist.
Mm.
You know, so he's
yeah, that's right. He went on to say, look, you know, my father whipped you with whips. I'm going to whip you with scorpions and so on and so forth, which didn't really work out for him very well.
Akravim is not really scorpions. It's probably some really thorny plant, or it was you know, a whip that had, like, you know, piece of metal at the end or something pretty nasty.
Really? Anyhow, he didn't turn out too popular.
No, he wasn't. And he was actually the northern kingdom. They tried to kill him. You know, he sent his worker, his minister that deals with taxes, and they stoned him to death. And he had to jump on his chariot and run home.
Mm.
But anyhow, basically what happens in verse 19, the people say, oh, then it's going to be stubborn. They weren't even interested. We're not even listening to this. We don't care.
Yeah. It was like, yeah, whatever, old man, but we want to have a king. So can you just work it out?
Yeah. And they're actually pointing out what their thing is. And we want to be like, it says in verse 20, and we shall be like the rest of the nations, and he'll be our judge, he'll be our judge and our king, and he'll go before us, and he'll fight for us, and he'll fight our wars. And it says, and Samuel heard the words of the people, and he went to God and basically said, okay, this is what the people are saying. And God said to him, you know, listen to their voice, and you'll give them a king, And what's interesting, he says, he goes back, you know, he's praying, he gets the answer, he turns around and says, he's probably on the spot. It's like on the spot. And he basically says, okay, everyone go home, and now we have to find someone. And this leads into the next story, which is the crowning, or the anointing of Saul as king.
The anointing of Saul as king. But I want to ask you a question about that last sentence, because it is an interesting sentence, because, yes, you're right, you know, Samuel repeats everything that the people say to Yehovah, and Yehovah basically says, give it to them. This is what they want. We've warned them. They rejected me as their leader, as their king. So, and we've told them what's going to happen. They've said, don't even care. Just do it. This is what we want. Fine. You can have what you want. And quite often, you know, isn't it the way that he will give us what we want as a form of judgment upon us? And it seems to be the case here. But then the last sentence of the 1 Samuel chapter 8, I've got in the English, and Samuel said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city, is what I've got.
He's basically telling them, go home. Go
home for now. There's nothing else in that. Okay.
Yes, everyone go back to his city. And what's interesting, he uses the term city and not a tent. It's interesting. There's this term, Ish lo halecha Yisrael, each man of Israel go to your tent. The reason he's using the term city here, probably, unlike cases where we have like rebellion, so they're rebelling against the king or against the system, they say tent, because a tent represents the unpermanent, the desert-like nomad reality Israel was in with no leadership and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And now he's saying the term city. It's using the term city because of the fact that, okay, now we're becoming more and more established. There's going to be a kingdom here, and it's different now. So it's using a different term. You have these little subtleties hinted here and there. Mm. So this is the beginning of the establishment of the kingship, which means we're going to use the term city and not the term tent.
There it is. Okay. Hey, listen, while you were talking, I just saw a cross-reference, so I've just jumped over there quickly, and maybe we'll pick up from here next week, but it's Hosea 13, Hosea, right? Hosea? Is that how you say it in the Hebrew?
Hosea.
Hosea. 13 verses 9 to 11, it says, O Israel, you are destroyed, but your help is from me. I will be your king. Where is any other that he may save you in all your cities? And your judge to whom you said, give me a king and princes. I gave you a king in my anger, and I took him away in my wrath.
I was actually thinking of that verse when we were talking about when we just mentioned the response of God. I was actually thinking about that verse, and I was trying to figure out where exactly it was. Natati lechem melech be'api, and it's a very, very powerful verse. Hosea, remember, Hosea was a king, it was a prophet in the north. And they were dealing with a lot of very, very corrupt kings throughout the centuries. Mm. And there is an element, it's very interesting. The Bible basically turns around and says, God is the king. Whoever he puts here on earth to be his messenger is only a messenger. They're only facilitating the concept of the kingship of God. But the real king is God. Amen. And that's it. There's no one else besides him. He is the king. End of story. And anyone that comes in, it's very interesting, for example, in the book of Ezekiel, the king, he's not called a king, he's called a nasi. It's nasi, this means from the word of exalted one. But he's not referred as king. And that's a very, very interesting point. Basically, in the future, there will be no king. There will only be a representative of God on earth, but he's not going to be God. He's not going to be the one that replaces God. He's just a representative. Mm-hmm. And that's the mindset the Bible was trying to push. You know, we're going to call him king and stuff like that, but the real king is actually God. And this is part of the point. This is what this section here is trying to say. They know they haven't forsaken you. They're just fed up of me being their king.
Yep. And so this is where we're going to pick up in chapter 9 next week when Shaul is chosen to be king. Yoel ben Shlomo, my friend, thank you once again for coming back on Light of the Prophets and taking us through 1 Samuel chapter 8. Thank you to Prince Halevi IV, who's been such a good boy today.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is. And
he's a good little mascot.
Yeah, but what? Mascot? Seriously? I want to thank everyone who listens to Truth to You. I want to thank everyone for liking my Facebook page.
Yeah.
We're getting closer to 1,100 people. It's growing. I lose people here and there sometimes. You know, it happens. But we're slowly getting there. It's pretty cool. I'm quite mind blown by the support. questions that people bring up, support. I know when I put up things about, you know, a rocket dropped here or something like that, people were very, very supporting. You know, and people were praying prayers. By the way, if people can pray for, I actually don't know her name, but it's a mother of a it's the mother-in-law of one of my students. And I actually don't have a name, and I apologize for that. I'm trying to keep updates about what's going on with the mother-in-law, but she's very, very sick and she's in hospital. So when this recording comes out, I hope she gets better. But if she doesn't, you know, please generally pray for her. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even know her name. But
she's mother-in-law of one of your students, and she's so ill at the moment that she has to take to hospital. So. If listeners would keep her in mind. And just a reminder, Yoel, one of your students, what do you do in case people have just tuned in for the first time?
What do you mean?
Come on, it's Hebrew in Israel.
Oh, okay. So I have an email address. You can email me and I can send you details of my my Hebrew program for beginners. If you already know how to read and write and stuff like that, I have an intermediate for intermediate students. Basically, send me an email to Hebrew in Israel, one word Hebrew in Israel @gmail.com. You can contact me. Essentially, at the moment, I'm actually fully booked, but you can basically go on a waiting list, and there is one. I've been able to, you know, move people around to actually enable more people to get in. The course itself is mostly for beginners. You learn how to read and write. You learn the alphabet. You learn how all the vowel points. We go over a lot of the morphology. We read text. We try to understand. Students can also bring up questions regarding very, very specific verses. Mm-hmm. One rule is that I don't answer questions regarding, you know, why Jews don't believe in Yeshua or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I have my ground rules.
We have a different program for that anyway.
And yeah, you have a different program for that one, which, by the way, I don't even comment on. I've listened to a couple of them, but I don't comment because it's not what I deal with.
It's not your thing. Your thing is Hebrew in Israel. And by the way, it's Hebrew in Israel on the Facebook page as well. So if you want to find Yoel on Facebook, Hebrew in Israel. If you want to get Hebrew lessons, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. If you'd like to get on the waiting list. Fair enough?
Yeah, exactly. And just, you know, we work through mutual respect, you know, but if students have to feel very free to ask questions, if it's a question I don't want to answer, just say respectfully, I don't want to answer that one, you know, because we're studying text. So we're trying to study text through context, text through the words themselves, stuff like that, historical context as well. And we try to flow through the Bible to understand it. You know, we take text from Torah, from the prophets, from the Psalms. You know, there's a bit of syntax here and there. By the way, biblical syntax is kind of tricky, so we only learn part of it. As far as I know, all my students are very, very pleased. Some of them even commented on the Facebook page mentioning that I'm a good teacher, and I thank them for this.
A good teacher? What are you talking about? You think you'd be on the program if I didn't think you were a good teacher? All right, so there it is. Hebrew in Israel Facebook page, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. And until next week, dear listeners, be set apart and be blessed by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom.